Labor and Consumer Affairs will come to order. Welcome, committee, and everyone. Hope you had a good weekend. We have a very good committee meeting this morning. We're going to have an informational meeting from Intel. We have two members of Intel here to speak to us, and we're very excited about that. Then we'll be having hearing two bills, and we'll have some committee measures since this is the last day to drop bills. So it'll be a busy, busy day for a lot of us. So with that, I'd like to welcome Jim Johnson and Keith Thompson to come up to present to us for Intel.
Madam Chair, Jim hasn't made it yet, so it's
okay.
Just Keith. Former
All right.
Intel.
Excuse me, it'll be Keith Thompson, former Intel Vice President and Site Manager.
Instead of the Intel and or the Keith and Jim show, it'll just be the Keith show for a moment.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Keith Thompson. I reside in Portland, Oregon. Retired from Intel a few years ago after being with them for almost 30 years and being part of bringing Intel to Oregon. My understanding is that your committee is interested in what can a community do to get its own Intel Corporation. And I'll be happy to recite a couple stories for you. First of all, how Intel came to Oregon, and then how Intel expanded in Oregon. They're actually two quite different stories, but both of them are still relevant to today's economic development. Going back into the early 70s, Intel wanted to expand out of Silicon Valley for a variety of reasons, some of them somewhat comical. We wanted to get away from the San Andreas Fault. We didn't realize we were getting next to Mount St. Helens, but it's no matter where we go in the West, Mother Nature always has some surprise waiting for us. As we wanted to expand, we limited our search to sites that were within 1 to 2 hours of commercial airline commutes. The way Intel operated then and continues to operate now is that it's a very close-knit community, and we wanted our engineers and managers to be able to fly to a factory or a site, put in a reasonable day's work, and be able to fly home and be home with their family at night. So that opened areas like Seattle, Reno, Phoenix, Salt Lake City, and we did a cursory look at those, and we got a call from someone on Tektronix's board to Gordon Moore, one of our founders, who said, we understand you're looking for sites on the West Coast. You really ought to come take a look at Portland. We operate here. It's a nice community, good workforce, good quality of life, and quite frankly, we're sort of tired of being the only high-tech game in town. Myself and another fellow got on AirCal, flew up to Portland, met the realtor that we had contacted, and we had set as a criteria we'd like to find an industrial parcel of 30 acres in size. In the 1970s, 1974 exactly, there were two. One in Wilsonville, where the Tektronix world headquarters was for a while and is now Xerox, and one in Aloha off of TV Highway. Now what we were looking for, since we were growing very rapidly, is something where we could just come right in, design a building, and build. I'll use the term shovel-ready land. So the infrastructure is there, the utilities are in, the streets are in, and that's what startups need when they are looking for fast expansion, and that's what we were looking for. We had a meeting with Tektronix that same day, flew back that night, had a meeting with Gordon Moore the next day and said, we saw two sites. Everything looks good. There's proof of life of technology with Tektronix operating there. We think we could operate very satisfactorily, and we purchased the 30-acre site off of TV Highway in Aloha. We started construction in 74 and built what we call Fab 4. That's the facility. That's a large capital investment where we do the wafer fabrication of the semiconductor before it goes offshore for assembly and then to whoever the customer is for integration into a personal computer or other piece of electronic gear. The key points from that search is that if you're a startup, you're usually not large enough or sophisticated enough to look for tax breaks or to do a major greenfield type of site selection. greenfield meaning that the streets aren't in, the utilities aren't there, and you have the time and ability to bring those in before you want to expand. Startups need buildings. They need land. They need that land ready to develop. Speed was the most important thing to us in the early 70s. We started operation of Fab 5 in, Fab 4 in 1976, and we continued to expand. We had a good relationship with the state. I was still in Silicon Valley at that time, and we continued to want to expand out of California. You may have noted when I talked about the sites that we were looking for in that first site selection, I didn't mention any cities in California. California at that time had a reputation, and we had the actual experience of not being open for business. And so we weren't going to expand in California. It wasn't business friendly. Tax structures, the ability to work on getting permits, the congestion that we saw starting to happen in Silicon Valley and the Los Angeles basin, we said we're not going to go there. So the main thing to take away from that early 70s is be ready to handle startups, be ready to give them what they need at that time, and that's not necessarily tax breaks, but it is shovel-ready land, quality of life, good workforce, utilities, that sort of thing. Well, as we continued to grow and prosper in the 80s and 90s, we brought more and more groups up to Oregon. We wanted to expand. We were growing more than doubling every year. And so we then brought up a design group. So we had a fab area and a design group. And then we brought up a systems manufacturing group that made what was called single board computers at the time. And that started Hawthorne Farms, and then we went into Jones Farm. These were all campuses. And each time we expanded to a new campus, our appetite for land expanded. We initially bought 30 acres. When we went into Jones Farm or Elam Young Parkway, we went for 60 acres. When we went to Jones Farm, we were now at 125, expandable to 150. Our last expansion in Oregon was Ronler Acres. That was a 300-acre site. So as the company grew, so did our need for available land. Now, none of those expansions were fab areas. We continued to operate Fab 4 and Fab 5 in Aurora, but fab areas were getting very expensive. They were costing more than $1 billion to put up a state-of-the-art fab area. And the tax structure in Oregon would not allow that to happen when you compared it to other states. During the 80s and 90s, we also expanded into Arizona as well as New Mexico. And they had tax structures and incentives that took capital projects like a fab area and made them very economically feasible to operate there. There were two proposed projects that Oregon competed for, and they lost both of them. It was at that time that OEDD, working with Intel, came up with the Strategic Investment Program, which is the program for capital-intensive projects where you can cap your property taxes if you invest more than $100 million. Oregon won the next two competitions in that arena because they changed that tax structure. That was a major expansion in Aloha and the start of Ronler Acres. So now you get into the next phase of corporate life, which is a large, complex, growing, sophisticated corporation where site selection surveys may take over 2 years. They may cost between $5 and $10 million worth of consulting, trips, site selection. I remember when we selected a greenfield site in Dallas-Fort Worth, that process took over 2 years. Started with a consultant that identified over 300 municipalities that wanted Intel-type jobs and laid out a horrendous spreadsheet of all the various criteria of how these cities ranked against one another. So after 2 years, we purchased a 300-acre site outside of Fort Worth. That's a very different phase, and that's a different sort of thing where you as a state need to have the tools necessary to attract a major corporation such as an Intel as it has evolved into the 1990s. Their speed is no longer of the essence. The corporation has the resources and capabilities to spend several million dollars in 2 years selecting a site, doing all the math of what the economies of scale are to operate there, doing a greenfield type where you can bring in the utilities, bring in the infrastructure and the streets, and then start to build your operation. Now, what I've described are really two different phases where the state needs tools, startups as well as sophisticated. I would encourage you to think of a third phase, and that is keeping what you've got. That is also economic development. And Oregon must do all three to have a vigorous, vital economy. For startups, as I've said, you need shovel-ready land, perhaps spec buildings, an open-for-business attitude to help the startups through permitting processes, utilities, that sort of thing. For mature corporations, you need large, zoned industrial parcels of land. Those are getting extremely few in the metropolitan area. Outside the metropolitan area, we do have that as a state. Once again, you need the open-for-business attitude, and you need incentive tools like the Strategic Investment Program as those companies look at the competition between states. And this is a competition. There are at least 49 other states out there that would like to have what you have in your major corporations. And they will do lots of things to try and woo those companies to them. They also have economic development departments. They also have tools. So you need to have all these tools in your kit to try and have a vigorous economic development. For keeping what you have, you must be and be perceived as competitive. We've gotten a lot of media recently, some of it in the funny papers, some of it in the headlines. None of that is going to help us in economic development. If the perception in the decision makers is that we are letting our education system into a death spiral, if they hear that we disconnect from the federal tax code, which may give you short-term revenue, I'm here to tell you that that will set off all sorts of red flags in the bean counters as they do these spreadsheets and compare Oregon to the other states that say this state is not competitive. Now, you may get a short-term revenue boost by disconnecting from the federal tax code, and you won't see something happen to Intel overnight or some of the other large corporations. But within a 5 to 10 year period, what you will see is that as these companies go through their economic cycles, in the downturns, the areas where the cutbacks will be in the states that are not competitive. The areas where the growth will be during the economic upturn will be in the states that are competitive. So in the theme of keeping what you've got, you need to remain competitive as you look at your competition as they go after the jobs that you currently have. Now, what I've listed are three different things that I think we as a state need to do to remain competitive and to attract economic development. And certainly we need to do those, but those alone won't do it. We need to get our house in order. We need to have stable school funding K through 16. We need to invest in focused education for the economy as we see it evolving. We need to maintain and improve our transportation infrastructure, and we certainly need to improve our tax system to provide for these stable funding. Oregon is in a world of hurt right now. The economy has really caused us to be in a state of crisis and chaos. But these are the best times to make change. These are the best times to realize what the shortcomings are and try and improve them for the future. I think the Oregon business plan that was laid out at the Economic Summit laid it out quite well, that we need to balance the budget. We need to fix PERS. We need to fund education. We need to make it effective as well as efficient. In higher education, you'll be seeing a Higher Education Efficiency Act. We need to allow our schools to use every dollar to their best advantage. We need to improve the tax system, and we need to be ready for economic development with land, incentives, an open for business attitude, and like all good farmers, we need to sow lots of seeds, because it's from those seeds that the next Intel will come. So I'd be very happy to answer questions for you.
Representative Kidd.
Welcome today, and just for the record, Intel, most everything you're talking about is in my district, and Representative Gallegos, I know as well, as a major player for Intel here in the state capitol, so thank you for being here. When you talk about improving our tax structure, we hear that a lot. Can you give me some specifics on, if you were in this chair right now, what you would do from a business perspective to improve our tax structure?
The tax structure is very variable with the economic cycles. And there are proposals out there, and I'm not going to, it's hard to say which one is the right one. Most people say you have to have a three-legged tax stool with some sort of consumption or sales tax, as well as property tax, as well as income tax. I don't know if that's the right solution for Oregon or not, but the current system, which is so susceptible to economic swings, really needs to have some sort of balance to it so that we're not that susceptible to it. We've heard about rainy day funds, putting away money in the good times, which we didn't do. All those things should be taken into consideration as we look at what we can do to the tax system. And I understand there are a number of committees working on a variety of proposals. I think this is absolutely an opportune time to have a very vigorous debate on what are the ways in which we can stabilize our tax structure.
Yeah,
follow up.
With Intel coming to our state and choosing our state, for the committee's sake, can you tell us what our number one tool, as you speak of, was that brought Intel here over these 49 other states, so that we can see that as an example that we can continue to follow in the future to hopefully bring more Intel-like companies to Oregon? Is there one thing that set us out above the 49 others?
In the beginning, there was not. It was convenient. You had a well-serviced international airport. You had a couple parcels of land available. You had a very stable workforce. And you had a couple technology companies between ESI and Tektronix that were operating successfully here. I think as one of the individuals that came up and selected the state, what impressed me was the livability, the ability. One of the reasons that we were leaving California was that as a company that was doubling every year, we could not hire a young person and have them have the ability to buy a house any closer than 2 hours by commute. The ability to spend 10 minutes to get from your home to your workplace was a big advantage. So, in looking through, I visited a number of cities when we did that site selection. Seattle felt a lot like Santa Clara. We were not interested in Reno. Salt Lake City, we were not interested in. And Phoenix, we were interested in, but we felt for our first fab area, this would be a better place.
Thank you.
Representative Shoffler.
Thank you. I can personally attest to benefiting from Intel expanding. I spent many happy hours pouring concrete out in a law.
We do use a lot of concrete.
I believe we can make a commitment to K through 12 here in Oregon, and I believe we can find land and zone for expansion. I don't think we will disconnect from the federal tax system, because I don't think there's a vote in this building to do it. That doesn't mean I may not want to, but what specifically And what you make some very ominous statements about if we do. I certainly don't want to run Intel out of Oregon. That's the last thing in the world I want to do. What specifically did these properties or governments in Fort Worth, New Mexico, and Arizona offer Intel that we didn't have to offer at the time? And do we have that to offer now? And if we don't, what do we need to do to make that so?
In the 90s, when we were building billion-dollar fab areas, what they had to offer was basically tax incentives for capital-intensive projects. What happens when you build a billion-dollar fab area, it's, as you mentioned, it's a large building with lots of concrete, but inside that building is very expensive capital equipment that a small piece of production equipment may cost between $1 and $3 million, and that equipment becomes obsolete in 4 to 6 years. So when you have depreciation and property taxes on $1 billion, and it's because the equipment is so high and you're not putting that large of load on the government infrastructure, it's very difficult to operate there. What New Mexico and Arizona had were tax systems that allowed that billion-dollar investment not to generate that large a tax bill. And that's what the Strategic Investment Program did for Oregon. It said if you come in and you invest $100 million, then we will cap the property tax bill at that $100 million. And what you get in return is you give 25% of your tax saving to the local community, and you save the rest of the tax savings, the $100 million being enough to fund the infrastructure that is necessary to support that particular enterprise.
Madam Chair, may I
follow up?
And then we in return, I look at it as an investment that we make in your business, and then we in turn reap the rewards from all the revenue that's generated from that business. And do you have any idea the difference between our investment, just a round number, a ballpark, the difference between our investment and the amount of revenue that we brought in due to that investment?
Well, I'm not sure I'll answer it exactly in those two ways. And in fact, Intel will be releasing a new economic impact study. So my data is a little old because I've been out of Intel for 4 or 5 years. But the last time I was involved in it, it was a 10-to-1 return on investment.
Thank you.
Representative Burns.
Good morning. I represent an area of rural Oregon, and we kind of slouch down in our seats when we talk about someone on the level of Intel and say to ourselves, there's just no way we could ever do that. I recorded 6 different areas that you mentioned. Local control is available in, out of 4 out of those 6. Obviously, local doesn't have anything to do with the tax structure in the state and that kind of thing. But one of the problems, we can do 4 out of the 6 locally. Any rural community could. But in your, I think in the first sentence, you mentioned airline service.
Mm-hmm.
And airline service to rural Oregon is almost non-existent. Would that eliminate, even if you had everything else in place, would a lack of airline service really dictate that no, you wouldn't even consider a site in a rural area, not only Oregon but anywhere?
I think you have to look at it from 2 different perspectives. As a city kid from the San Francisco Bay Area, when I flew into Oregon in the early 70s, Portland looked pretty rural.
Well, I lived in Burlingame.
Okay.
So I know.
So you know what I'm speaking about. That was an advantage to us. So I don't think rural Oregon ought to give up or think that they can't get a large corporation. We put a site in DuPont, Washington. Now, that's 20-30 minutes from SeaTac or from Olympia, so it was not quite like being right next to PDX. But what we do is, if we do build a major site, we'll put our own airline in. We have flights running out of Hillsboro on a daily basis to most of our major sites, and that again is the philosophy of our people have to interact, and we prefer that they do a lot of that face-to-face, and so we make it very convenient for them to fly back and forth to our various locations as they transfer products and processes. But I think rural Oregon ought to look at putting in infrastructure that will attract startups. I think rural Oregon doesn't have a lot of international flights, but they do have feeder flights. And for most startups, that can get you started. It would be nice to have a PDX all around the state, but we don't. So you shouldn't give up, but it will make it is a barrier, because a lot of companies operate the same way Intel does, with lots of face time between their employees. You have to do what you can to try and minimize that as a barrier.
Thank you for keeping a light on the candle for rural Oregon. We appreciate that.
Mr. Thompson, I have a similar question. In the 90s, Oregon had about half of our mills go out of business. We have industrial sites all over the state that may not look that attractive right now, but they have their utilities, they have access to roads, they have access to shipping. But they are in rural areas, same type of question. Do you see any opportunity to use existing sites that are all over the state?
Well, I think that you will need to see what you can do to make it easy for the type of business that is looking to expand or locate somewhere to overcome going into a redevelopment site versus a greenfield site. A lot of the large corporations that have the ability to go to a greenfield site will go to states where it's very easy, where there is land that has been zoned. I mean, when we did our site selection in Fort Worth, we took a helicopter ride out to the potential site, and you could look down, and there were freeways. No cars, actually no roadbed yet, but the freeways were all laid out, the overpasses were all installed, just waiting for some company to locate there, and then they would go and build, put the roadbed in. That's a lot easier for a corporation to do than to take over a site that may have contamination, may have a lot of demolition costs to it, may have a lot of baggage. So if there's anything that you can do to encourage people to take those sites and help them overcome that baggage, that would be beneficial.
Thank you. Representative Gallegos.
Yes. It looks like we might be out of questions, and I just want to make sure I said thank you. I grew up in Hillsboro, and Hillsboro changed in the 70s. It was a quiet community, but I have to say that it changed for the better. Intel not only did it create jobs, but people like Mr. Thompson invested an incredible amount of time in the communities. So there's a big return on the investment of the individual energies back into the community as far as education. Some of the community programs that Intel started, they're phenomenal, and they've grown, and I think they've set a pattern for a lot of other companies today. So thank you for coming today. I appreciate your message.
Thank you.
Mr. Thompson, I have a question that's come from the audience, if I could ask you. Can you give us some ideas specifically how the state can help create this shovel-ready industrial land that you gave the example of in terms of legislation and agencies?
I guess I don't know if there are any barriers in the form of legislation to creating this type of property. There are a variety of communities in the state that have already done this. They'll have industrial parks. Hillsboro has industrial parks, the Tannisbourne area, where you have land that is ready to go. Now, I'm not quite sure how that got there, whether a developer said, I'm going to put my own money in, or whether the state or the local municipality did, but somebody did and had a forward-looking view that if I first of all build some property and then maybe I'll put in some spec buildings, it's kind of like build it and they will come. As I drive over to Bend and I drive through Madras, there's an industrial park on the outskirts of Madras that looks like it's shovel-ready for people to come in and do a building. So it's that kind of foresight that is necessary, and I don't know whether there's legislation that prohibits that or not.
Senator Merkley has a question.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. In the last biennium, one of the major pieces of tax legislation was the super sales factor. And Intel was discussed as being one of the primary beneficiaries of that change in tax law, which cost about $70 million just in the last biennium, and more this time. Was that a tax strategy that was the best dollar use of the state in attracting and retaining a company like Intel?
I don't have any knowledge on that since I was out of Intel at that time, and I would be the wrong person to try and answer that. Jonathan with Intel is here, and he may have a view on that if he wishes to speak to it.
Please.
Yeah,
sure. Please.
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, I wasn't in this position at that point either, so I wasn't a part of the legislative strategy that you're referring to. I am familiar with the issue. My understanding of that issue is, following up on Keith's third point, is it's designed to retain and support companies that have made investments in the state of Oregon. And my understanding as well is that while there may be short-term costs associated with that tax strategy, the long-term benefits greatly outweigh any short-term issues. Again, not an issue that I worked in the last biennium, but that's my understanding.
Thank you.
Representative Rosenblum.
Thank you. Good morning. I am curious, and I think your testimony, Jim, alluded to it a little bit, about the perception that Oregon is getting it. With all these national media stories, they seem to be becoming the poster child for a state in crisis in terms of funding, and particularly education funding, most lately in Doonesbury. And I wonder if you could comment on to what extent that is a problem in recruitment of businesses or expansion here, and what you think we should be doing about that as a state.
I believe it is a problem, mainly because these decisions of expansion by major corporations will basically be made by people that are sitting in an office in Arizona, California, anywhere else. They have no emotional tie to Oregon. They may have an operation here already. They may be satisfied with that operation. They may not. But whenever they hear something like this, it may not be pertinent to them at the time, but when their facilities people approach them with an expansion plan and they see Oregon on the list, they'll remember that headline. They'll remember that Doonesbury comic, and they will ask a question. Hopefully by that time, we'll have those issues solved and we'll be on a much more stable footing. But if they were to ask that question now, I would tell you that there are a lot of red lights on that say, well, why do I want to locate there? A lot of people say, well, the high-tech industry supports education because they want public education to educate their workers. That couldn't be further from the truth. High-tech is really involved in education because our employees are involved in education. One of the first questions that a new hire asks when they come to Intel is, what school district should I choose to buy a house in? These people are all highly educated. They value education. They want their children to have an excellent education. And they will make career decisions based on the education that they perceive that they're going to get. Last time we did a demographics for Intel, I don't think we had very many people in Vancouver, Washington. I think that would change now because you're starting to hear of families relocating just to get their children a proper education. They also want their children to be able to go to higher education within the state. I think most of us as parents would like to see that. And so if we don't invest in higher education, they will send them out of state also. So I think it is a problem because these perceptions are easy to come by and hard to correct. And it will take years for us to live down that Doonesbury comic. It will take years for us to live down other decisions if we get a bad reputation in the executive offices and boardrooms of major corporations looking to expand, very difficult to change those perceptions back.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Thompson, and I want to echo Representative Gallego's comments. I want to thank her for inviting you here today. It's been very helpful to us. And I want to tell those who weren't here about Mr. Thompson before he goes. He is the former Oregon site manager for Intel, vice president at Intel, and he was very key working with Governor Barbara Roberts and the Oregon Economic Development Department to bring Intel in through President Craig Barrett. And thank you for blessing the state with the prosperity that Intel has brought us.
Okay. Enjoy it here. Thank you.
Okay, committee, we're going to move to closing an the informational meeting and opening a public hearing on House Bill 2682. And I have the staff read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2682 requires criminal background checks for loan originators. It also requires that insurance agents and insurance consultants who are employed will sign as loan originators to comply with the loan originator training, examination, and continuing education requirements. Thank you.
Okay, first I'm going to call forward, in the interest of time, we'll call the panel of John McCulley, Oregon Association of Mortgage Brokers, Ed Trompke, Oregon Association of Mortgage Brokers, and is it Matt?
Milt.
Matt Milt, excuse me, Milt Cheever. Morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you for having us before you this morning to discuss House Bill 2682. My name is John McCulley. I'm representing the Oregon Association of Mortgage Brokers, and I have with me on my left Milt Cheever, who's president of Cheever Mortgage in Albany and is also chair of our legislative committee, and Ed Trompke, who's an attorney in the Portland area who has an extensive background in dealing with the mortgage lending industry. Let me first just give you a quick overview of what brought us here. Last session, the legislature adopted a fairly comprehensive educational requirement for mortgage loan originators. And I should say that, just to make sure people are understanding here, mortgage loan originators are the people who deal directly with the public, the consumers who are coming in to get a mortgage loan. Last session, you approved legislation that required those people to get initial training, pass an examination, and also have continuing education. We believe that it was a very important move for the profession to make to upgrade the standards of the people who are working directly with the public. We bring to you this time House Bill 2682 to do two things. First, it does close a loophole that we discovered with the passage of House Bill 2764 last session. In that bill, there was some concern from the insurance industry that many of their employees also write mortgage loans as a part of an overall financial package that they would offer to their customers. We agreed at that time to provide an exemption for people who are licensed insurance agents or insurance consultants, an exemption from the education requirements of last session's legislation. Since that time, we have discovered that there are people working full-time in the mortgage lending industry who also may hold an insurance license. And they are saying that, well, I hold an insurance license, therefore I do not have to comply with any of the education requirements that other full-time loan originators do. These are people who are working for mortgage brokers. They are in the business as their principal source of income and are getting around the education requirements that are imposed on everybody else in the industry. So we believe that that loophole needs to be closed. And if a person is working full-time in this profession, that person needs to meet the same education requirements as everyone else. We have had conversations with the insurance industry, and we understand there may be some concern over what is meant by full-time, and I think John Powell, representing State Farm, will testify here about a suggested amendment that we would agree with. So just to let you know, coming attractions. The second part of the bill requires criminal background checks for these people who are dealing directly with the consumers. It may seem kind of unusual for a small business organization like ours, the average size of a mortgage broker is about 6 employees, to come to you to ask for more regulation, but we think it's appropriate in this case. The loan originator who is dealing with the consumer, and those of you who have maybe dealt with mortgage brokers know, you hand over your most personal financial information. You may hand over tax returns, you hand over employment records, Social Security numbers, residential addresses, all sorts of personal information are in the hands of the loan originator. We think it makes good public policy that each of those loan originators have a criminal background check conducted on them. And we are proposing in this legislation that it be the responsibility of the mortgage broker who is employing that loan originator to pay for that criminal background check. That will cost, according to the firms we've talked to, $15 to $25 per person. You see in the bill that the criminal background check would be enhanced with rulemaking authority given to the Department of Consumer and Business Services to put meat on this issue as to, you know, how far back you do the search, what do you do with the information once you find it, what crimes would constitute concern, and I've tried to answer those in the testimony that I've provided you. We think the background check should go at least 10 years back. That would be consistent with current requirements in the statute that if there is a complaint against a loan originator that is found to be valid, that complaint stays on that loan originator's record for 10 years. We think consistency in a criminal background check going back 10 years makes sense as well. Relative to the class of crimes that could be involved, Mr. Tronke here has come up with the idea, and I think it's a good one, to look at the rules of evidence for impeaching a witness as the potential for selecting the crimes that might fall into this category of raising a red flag about a loan originator. And then a final question, what happens if you find one of those crimes? Nothing in the bill talks about that. Our preference is that they find another profession, that they not be dealing directly with consumers if they have committed some of those crimes, which include fraud, misrepresentation, and other even more serious crimes against persons. But all of these things would be worked out in the rulemaking process. And I should tell you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, the BCBS has done an excellent job in implementing the law that passed last session. I think they were surprised, as we were, at the number of loan originators who had to go through the education process. We were thinking maybe 4,000 to 5,000. It's closer to 8,000. And so they have been overwhelmed by the number of people who are going through this process. But they have done it very efficiently and very effectively, and I just want to publicly state our appreciation to them for the work they have done in implementing last session's law. So we come to you with 2682 today to enhance what happened last session. We think this produces positive legislation that offers consumers protection. It also offers our brokers protection as well. I have to tell you, there have been instances where people who have been hired in these small businesses who have embezzled money and otherwise harmed those businesses. And so we are doing this selfishly as well. And we think the bill that we bring to you today makes good public policy sense for the state, and would be happy to answer any of your questions.
John, I congratulate you on what looks like a very good concept. I guess one of the questions I have is, I've been looking at a lot of bills from places like Florida and Georgia, and they're pages and pages and pages long because they don't leave a lot to the rulemaking process, it looks like to me. They spell everything out. We tend to come with half-page bills sometimes and leave a lot to the agencies. And you mentioned the 10-year period, how far back would you go? Why wouldn't you put that into the bill if you feel that that is really necessary?
Madam Chair, we could do that, and we honestly have talked about that in among our own organization of being very specific on these things. But there are different circumstances that might make a different time period more reasonable. Some have suggested 7 years, which would comply with, I think, certain federal lending requirements. So there may be different time periods that would work. We have no objection to putting it in the statute. We just wanted to go with as much flexibility as we could. It's important to know that the DCBS does have an advisory committee that they work with. It's actually put in the statute that they have to work with this advisory committee as they develop rules. And we think that there is enough input there to develop the rules that are flexible enough to meet all of the needs of the profession.
Okay. I guess my concern, as you said, would be how the records are stored, who has access to them, and that's tightly controlled.
Agreed, Madam Chair.
Questions? Representative Gerard.
If a loan originator is licensed, wouldn't a criminal check already have been done to preserve their license?
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Gerard, the loan originators are not licensed. The mortgage broker who hires the loan originator is licensed, and the broker is just the company that is licensed. So the people who would be working for that business are not licensed. The employer of the loan originators has to report the names of those people to DCBS, but there is no license, registration, anything with those people.
Okay. Further questions? Okay.
I have a question.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I may have missed in your testimony exactly how the background check translates into whether someone is or isn't hired. And did you say that those standards are set by a committee or by rule? Or I was looking for that in the legislation. Maybe you can help us out.
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, it is not specified in the legislation how that would happen. That would be developed by rule as to the types of crimes that would constitute the red flag being raised, and once that red flag is raised, what would be the consequence of someone whose criminal background check showed a positive outcome.
Is that an authority to develop rules pertaining to that in this piece of legislation?
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, yes, there is specific rulemaking authority provided to DCBS to make those rules. On page 1, lines 24 and 25, talk about that rulemaking authority provided to DCBS.
Okay, just
follow.
So I did see that line. That is broad enough to actually exclude people from the profession based on certain types of crimes and so on and so forth?
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, we believe that the rules could be put in place that would do that, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam
Chair. Appreciate it. And we will wait for an amendment, is that correct?
Yes, we are expecting some amendments working with Mr. Powell on those.
Okay, thank you so much. Call John Powell, State Farm.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Company. We appear before you today, as Mr. McCulley explained, with only one concern, and that is the definition of what is meant by full-time. State Farm has a bank, and their agents can originate mortgage loans. The average agent in Oregon this last year originated one mortgage loan. The goal of the company is for each agent to originate three a year. So these are part-time agents who are licensed under the insurance division. The concept of our amendment would be to define what full-time means by having a 60-day threshold in which an agent must produce other lines of insurance sales in that 60 days, or they would qualify as a full-time mortgage loan originator. And we would take that to Legislative Council for official drafting. That concept, then, if questioned, the agent would be able to prove that they're writing other lines of insurance if there was a question as to whether they are meeting this particular guideline. And that would catch the people who are just in this business full time. That's all I have, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
John, I guess I want you to further explain the 60 days. You're saying that over a 60-day period, that's all they do is write this type of loan? Or can you explain
that? Madam Chair, members of the committee, that is correct. It would simply set a threshold of in any 60-day period, you have to be writing other insurance business. You cannot just be writing mortgage loans.
So if they wrote one other policy in that 60 days, they would not qualify under this bill, is that correct?
Madam Chair, if they were just gaming the system, they'd have to continuously do that because any 60-day period would disqualify them.
Okay.
So it would be a major nuisance to somebody who was gaming the system to continuously do that.
All right. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Call Andrea Mayer, ACLU.
Chair Close, members of the committee, Andrea Mayer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. We're very concerned, I think, by the issues that a number of you raised on this bill in terms of the background check. I think you all issue spotted a number of important concerns about the agency and who's going to have access to this information, how far back is it going to go, what is going to constitute a basis for which someone will not get hired, does it include arrests or just convictions, what type of controls are put on this. When there are, and I'm not even clear what sorts of information will be included in a background check. I know in some background checks that law enforcement does, that includes fingerprints, and that gets into a whole different area. And so I have a lot of questions, and I don't have a lot of answers today, but we are quite concerned about this. Be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Gerard.
Ms. Byers, is this a serious problem in Oregon right now?
Chair Close, Representative Gerard, I'm not sure what you mean by serious problem, the issue of abuse by potential loan officers. I am not familiar with this issue whatsoever in terms of whether it is a problem and whether there actually have been abuses based on those getting hold of personal information and then using them for criminal activities. That would be the folks. I'm not familiar with it at all.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, that concludes the witnesses for House Bill 2682. So thank you for bringing this to us. Very interesting concept, and we will wait for the amendments on it. Closing the public hearing on House Bill 2682. And I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2737. And Megan, will you read the summary?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2737 prohibits a person in the course of offering real estate goods or services for sale, rent, or other disposition from transmitting an email message that misrepresents the subject or the origin of the message, makes it a violation of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, and this applies to offers made after the effective date of this act.
And we welcome Representative Haas to the committee, and we will have him present the bill.
Thank you, Chair Close. Mark Haas, House District 27. Thank you, committee, for hearing this bill. I have some testimony I'll hand out. I won't read it. I brought with me two guests, one Dr. Dana Smith from my district, and she has a compelling story about why there's a need for legislation like this, and Dan Woolich, who's one of the most prominent experts on Internet technology in our state. I don't think I need to tell you that spam is one of the most annoying features we have in our everyday technological life, and this bill simply does just what your administrator stated. It amends the Unlawful Trade Practices statutes to include email spam into it. So I'll let them tell their story about the need, and I think we're all here, and there are some other people who want to testify in favor of this bill. And Dan, would you like to start, or Dr. Ken?
Sure. Chair Close, members of the committee, I'd like to thank you for letting me testify today. For the record, my name is Dan Lulich, and I'm the Chief Technology Officer of a Portland-based electronic content filtering company called RuleSpace. And I'm here today to speak in favor or in support of House Bill 2737. As a computer scientist, I've spent my entire career working on issues like the one that's before you folks today. And I have to admit that when I first heard that about the anti-spam bill, I was a bit skeptical. But and I don't believe that the government should be in the technology business. However, I do believe that government should be in the law enforcement business. And I think that that's what this bill is about. And that's why it makes so much sense to me. It simply adds electronic email messages to the current law, where the state of Oregon has already said you can't mislead people, you can't lie to them, and you can't defraud them. And from my perspective, that brings the unlawful trade practices legislation into the digital age. I also like this bill for what it doesn't try to do. It doesn't try to get involved in the technology of filtering electronic mail or the technologies attempting to track down unscrupulous spammers over the internet. Some of these folks, these unscrupulous spammers, are really smart guys, and it's very difficult to shake them out. They know the tricks of the digital world better, I believe, than government legislators and litigators. Unfortunately, I also believe that this bill will not eliminate email spam, but it's a step in the right direction toward eliminating deceptive messages from people who want to steal from Oregonians. I also know that the state of Washington has a similar law, and it appears to be working. So I think that that gives us some direction. As a native Oregonian and as an expert in the technical methods for eliminating email spam, I strongly urge you to adopt this common sense approach. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Dan. Can you just tell us how this would come about happening? How does a person get this kind of information? How can they steal an email? Or do they just take it off?
Representative Close, members of the committee, there are many methods to doing this. One of the most common methods is called email spoofing. Email spoofing is a way to steal your identity through the electronic email, and it's basically a sleight of hand. Essentially, someone sends you a compelling email message that in its subject line draws you in to read it and may actually misrepresent an actual corporation or company. And in this email, they make a request. They say something like, there's been a problem with your email account or your login account to your financial institution, and you need to fix it. So if you could please resubmit your personal information to us, we will fix it for you. Thank you very much. And of course, you're misdirected. It's not actually going to the originator. It might be your bank, and it's actually going to somebody in Romania. And they're, of course, asking for your personal information, and they're going to go and withdraw funds from your bank. And it happens all the time. In addition to that, you know, there's pornography spam, where they, again, lure you in with innocuous and maybe even genuine-sounding subject lines like, "Hi, from Jennifer." And you click on the email, and you're presented with a pornographic image. Again, and then, you know, businesses misrepresenting their product. A letter from your mother, and you open it, and it's an ad for sending Mother's Day flowers, where you didn't really know that that was, you thought it was from your mom. So it's those kinds of deceptions. And it's very scary stuff.
Thank you. Okay. Chair Close, members of the committee, I'd like to testify today in favor of House Bill 2737. My name is Dr. Dana Smith. I reside and practice in Multnomah County, District 27. And my testimony today really relates to my own personal experience with spam and identity theft. 2 months ago, an herbal Viagra seller stole my email address and started sending out these ads looking like they were coming from me. I found out about this when I started receiving angry emails from people asking them why I'm sending these emails. I was just beside myself. I was, I can't stand receiving emails like this myself and to have people, misconstrue that I might be sending them out. I was very upset. So I decided to find out what was going on, went to a computer spam help site and found out, surprisingly, that this is a common problem. It happens. I talked to some people at work, and other people have had the same thing happen. It's very easy to do, and there's even websites that tell hackers how to do this. I decided at this point I was going to track this spammer down. And I used the internet headers and return email, and using several different databases on the internet, was able to track him down to his name, his address, his email account, and who his ISP providers are. He has about 10 to 15 different domain names that he rotates through in order to hide his identity. Well, I thought at this point, well, I've got him. So I said, well, okay, now what do I need to do next? I contacted the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office to see what my next step should be. They told me to contact the Texas Attorney General, which is where he resides in a small town in Texas, and I was told to fill out an online online complaint form, which I did, and got a kind of an electronic automated form reply, and I heard nothing back from them. Contacted the police in the small town in Texas where he resides, and I've heard no reply. I contacted the Oregon Attorney General's office, and unfortunately I got no reply from them. I contacted the Financial Fraud and Consumer Protection section in Salem and got an email directing me to contact the police in the town of record. He has an AOL account, so I figured, well, they're always priding themselves on family values. I'll contact them and let them know, and maybe they'll do something and spend a large amount of time, sent numerous emails to them, and never received a response back. He's got a Yahoo account, which is also promoting itself as being a very family-friendly site, and they sent me back, actually replied this time, they sent me back a reply saying they would not do anything. Because he's selling herbal Viagra and representing himself as a medical provider, I decided to contact the Oregon Division of the FDA. And they're telling me because he's using Viagra in the name of his product, in their eyes, they view this as a drug. It's no longer an herbal supplement. So I kind of see that, this is illegal on multiple levels. It's identity theft. He's using fraudulent advertising. He's practicing medicine without a license. He's impersonating me. He's using a federal mail to sell a prescription without a good faith exam by a medical practitioner. And it's just unwanted spam. It's been very frustrating. I've told my friends and colleagues at work that I was going to be testifying today, and almost universally, everybody said, oh, this is great. You've got to tell them that we can't stand this spam, and we're really upset that our children might see these ads. And I think this is a step in the right direction. I think that this is a problem that affects everybody, and I'd like to just end with a quote from Wired Magazine from October 2002. I think porn spam makes up 8% of the over 2 billion spams that were sent last year. That's a huge number. And thank you very much for listening to my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I had a couple of questions, Dana. You're a PhD or a MD?
Sure, close. I'm a MD.
You're an MD.
I'm using a physician.
I see. So this person then is saying that they are an MD by using your identity. Is that correct?
Chair Post, I think that he was lucky in that he got, I don't know. My name is in my email address, so I don't know, without knowing him, I don't know whether he knows that I am an MD or not.
I see. But it implies it, is that what you're saying?
Yes.
I see. Okay.
Sure.
Representative Shaw.
Thank you. My wife's a dentist, and she has doctor in her email address. I imagine this guy gets all of that, and my wife would be selling herbal Viagra to all over the country.
Yeah, same with me. Mine says Indiana.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So you were probably targeted by this individual. Yeah. And then, may I ask?
I follow.
The Washington law, did they see a marked decrease in this kind of activity after they passed it then? Representative Hass, please.
Yeah. Chair Close, Representative Chopler. They did. What they found was it became very easy for victims, if you will, to sue through their law perpetrators of this. And it's working really well. In fact, other states have built upon the Washington model. And I think, if there's ever a poster case for this, it's imagine seeing an email from your doctor saying, if there's a product that we think you should try, it's herbal Viagra, so you can see the damage to the reputation. And this bill would deal with those kinds of real cases.
Representative Carrard.
Representative, you and Representative Close ought to be congratulated for bringing this bill forward. Thank you.
I have to say it was mostly Representative Hass's idea.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, perhaps, and I apologize, Daniel. The letters from the Nigerian money launderers. I think every representative and senator has received a copy of that. What would, and I don't know whether maybe Representative Hass may be able to help on that one, how can you really stop I don't think that you can get rid of that by legislating it.
Is that not real?
It is, and I've got one I'm going to send you. Okay, I got a commission on one. I'll send you.
Chair Close, Representative Gales. There's many levels of this kind of email spam at different international spam, local spam, business spam, and each one of those individual levels, if you will, sort of have their own series of problems and complications and enforcement issues, etc. And the Nigerian spam problem, which did originate in Nigeria, believe it or not, but has sort of taken on a life of its own, copycatted many times around, is a very difficult kind of problem in the sense that what do you do about trying to prevent spammers in foreign countries with local legislation? And I really think that that's a very, very hard thing to do. Now, technology businesses try to offer technical solutions on the client side, on your computer, to try to eliminate those are so-called anti-spam packages. Email and ISP providers also try to build filtering and other kinds of blocking technologies in their ISPs, which are technical solutions to eliminate this as well. But legislative solutions against the Nigerian spam problem is an international trade issue. It's complicated. Doesn't mean that you can't go after them. I'm just saying that it might be difficult for an Oregon law to go after them.
But do you think so? A local law, an Oregon law, we can take care of a level perhaps of the local jurisdictional. Would the Department of Justice here in Oregon be able to go after this gentleman in Texas who is exploiting? You see that's working? I mean, a lot of questions. But
as it was explained to me by the Legislators' Council, there are mechanisms to go after these folks, even in Nigeria. They exist. I'm just saying that they are complex and complicated. There has to be a penalty associated with doing these acts and putting these people on notice and letting them know that indeed they will be fined or there's some sort of punitive measure associated with this may raise the bar on who's going to kind of come into this business in the future. And these professionals that are at it now, I think that they think they're going to get away with it for a long time and you may not be able to actually affect them. But there has to be at least some sort of way of putting them on notice. And I think that raising the bar is the important step that we're trying to take today.
No. Okay. Another question.
I will tell you, committee, we do have Jim Gardner coming up, who is an attorney that might be able to answer some of the legal questions. Paul?
Well, that's kind of my question. Are you going to, Representative Hass, are you going to look at reciprocal legislation perhaps in other states?
Chair Close, Representative Gallegos. I don't know about reciprocal legislation. I know there are about 18 states now that have similar laws to this. Frankly, this is the low-hanging fruit here. And the kind of spam that Dan's talking about that exists on the higher level is kind of international jewelry thieves that Oregon has a hard time going after. But this is something that can be done here to take care of Dr. Smith's problem and others. The Unlawful Trade Practices Act, and I think perhaps if we get the Department of Justice to confirm this, it is not uncommon for them under that statute to go after people out of state. And they will tell you that they can't recover the costs and damages from going after people who are going after
state. Great, thank you.
Chair, close point.
Okay.
Please.
Representative Shelton.
Dr. Smith, has this hurt your practice?
I don't think so. I'm a practicing anesthesiologist. I don't think people would think I work at a trauma center. I don't think people would construe it, but I can see how somebody else's practice could be.
Well, thank you very much for your testimony. Very interesting topic, and we will work on this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Call Jim Gardner and Jim Craven.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jim Craven representing the American Electronics Association, the Oregon Council of that group. That's a national, we're a national trade association. With me is Jim Gardner, who is representing Microsoft. I apologize to the chair that I have a 10 o'clock meeting with the governor's staff, so I have a few minutes. I'm going to have to bail, but Mr. Gardner's on my same page with me. We are not here today to represent spammers or to oppose government efforts to get some kind of at least minimal handle on this issue. The industry, including our large ISP providers, particularly America Online and Microsoft Network, are two of the largest ISP providers in the country. This is a war that they are battling themselves. It is a cost issue. It is a customer acceptance issue. I mean, it is costing every day AOL and Microsoft millions of dollars to just move this junk through their wires and to clog up their servers, to outrage their customers. And so they are, they have joined this battle is my basic message for you today. As to the particular bill, there is a parallel bill that has been introduced by Senator Metzger on the Senate side. There is a bill introduced by the Attorney General on the Senate side. Different kind of approach, thinking about trying to do no call like we did with telephones for the internet. We're not sure that's the answer, and Senator Nelson and the Senate Business Committee sent us all away 2 weeks ago to do a work group. We've met one time with technical advisors, with the Department of Justice staff, with Mr. Gardner, myself. Osberg was there. Representative Merkley has attended. He also has an interest in this issue. So I guess my message is today, this bill, we think, has a kernel of good stuff in it. There's about more than 20 states have done something on this. This bill has some of those key issues. We think there's actually some additional issues that could be added, including most states have said commercial solicitation should contain the letters ADV in the subject line. That's a pretty common in most of the states. So you could use then a private provider spam eliminator software on your machine, and just anything that says ADV doesn't come into your email box. So that's another element. And the final element, in most of the state laws around the country have explicit provisions to shield the ISP community from liability under a spam law. And the reason this is, if the spammers are sending stuff through AOL, AOL's not approving that, justifying it, supporting it at all. Most of the states have inserted legislation that says the ISP is not liable under an anti-spam law purely because someone's shoved something through their system. And the second element that is common in the states is that if the ISP is aggressively out there working with you as a customer to block spam, which they do now on all the major systems, that they don't incur a liability if they inadvertently prevent you from getting the liquid Viagra email that you wanted. I mean, you can kind of see where this is going. You know, we have to allow the people who are the allies in this fight to make sure that they, you know, because if they are aggressively blocking email, occasionally something you may have decided you wanted at some later case may have got stopped because you asked your ISP to help you in this battle. So language along those lines is pretty common in most of the state laws, too. So we think this bill, there's really nothing in this bill that we would oppose. Some of the elements of this bill are probably already illegal. It's probably, and DOJ is here, it's probably already illegal to steal somebody's name and computer fraud. But this would not, this would, you know, add explicitly making sure that that's illegal as far as emails go. So I guess my quick pitch is that there's a lot of people engaged in this issue. We welcome this committee's engagement. Hopefully, I mean, our bottom line interest would be to sort of work on one bill in the building. I mean, that's always our interest, is having one vehicle, but we understand sometimes multiple trains go down tracks, but we would like to help and offer our support to help coordinate those efforts. So between the House and the Senate, that we come up with one good vehicle that we can get passed and move forward on this issue. So some message today, and I do apologize, I do have to go speak with the governor's
staff. Can I pepper you with just a few questions?
Sure.
What did you say the Senate bill number was? Do you have the number that we could look at?
360. 261. Right. Senator Metzger has, I think, an almost absolute mirror of this bill in Senate Bill 261.
Okay.
And there's also Senate Bill 121, which is the Department of Justice's bill that's in Senator Nelson's committee in the Senate.
Okay. And can you give me one other state that you're aware of that has an act that is has the types of things you talked about in it?
Well, Madam Chair, the Washington Act has most of it. They were earlier on. It's been sort of improved and added. We'll furnish your staff with a, we have a list right here in front of us with about 20. There's a website called spamlaws.com, but we'll get a copy of that to your staff. There's about 20 some odd states that have fairly common law, common laws on this issue.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate you sticking with us.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, and I'm appearing today for Microsoft. I would echo the comments of Mr. Craven and kind of observe that we're in a very sort of odd position of saying this is a great bill, but it doesn't go quite far enough to regulate or deal with this this issue. The elements that, as Jim mentioned, that we would like to see added to it are the ADV subject line disclosure and also the liability shield, which is extremely important. That's important because this problem calls for a public-private partnership almost like no other issue does. There's certainly a legislative component to it, but there's a huge technology component which the private sector needs to bring to bear, and we think with advances in the technology of the sort that RuleSpace and other companies are pioneering, that's a feasible solution. I want to just give you a sense of the magnitude of this problem, and I'm going to quote from our competitor AOL in a recent communication to its members. They indicate that they're blocking at the ISP level up to 900 million spam emails every single day. That number is growing exponentially, and what that means to the single customer is an average of more than 27 per day per customer emails blocked. So if you think you got a lot, you know, that you're getting now, just imagine what you would get without that blocking going on. Microsoft offers even a more rigorous service, essentially an opt-in service, which says that if you want to, you can block incoming emails from anybody not on your address list. Now, that's a little restrictive because you might want to hear from somebody that's not on your address list already, but the technology exists to do that. We see the the four elements that Jim outlined as essentially the framework of an emerging national standard. We think that because this is a national and indeed an international problem, it's ideally an area that Congress would deal with. They haven't dealt with it yet, but there appears to be an emerging national standard built around those four key elements. One of the issues that has been raised in the work group and by the Department of Justice is whether or not there are state constitution problems with the ADV disclosure. They have taken the position that there may be a problem under the Oregon equivalent of the First Amendment, Article 1, Section 8. We don't think that's an insurmountable problem, but that's a topic of discussion in the work group. And what I think would be very useful, Madam Chair, would be perhaps you or Representative Haas or other members of the committee. I know Representative Gallegos has a very keen interest in the technology sector side, would be willing to kind of spend a little bit of time with the work group so we could come up with a common approach that would meet everybody's needs and make some progress on this issue.
Well, thank you. I think that's an excellent idea, and I would welcome your amendments myself on the liability shield and the you said it's ADV.
ADV disclosure on the subject line. Right. Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. And of course, we will need to speak with Representative Haas about that. If you would please keep Megan informed when the group meets, we will make sure that one of us is there.
Thank you, Madam.
Questions? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jim, I had one question about other states that are in this area. Do they generally all use the unlawful trade practices as the enforcing mechanism to...
You know, Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, I'm not that... A number of them do. I don't know if I could safely say that a majority do. I think we could... I think Cheryl Pellegrino from the AG's office is here, and they would probably be able to respond more accurately to that question.
Other questions? Well, thank you, Jim. That's been very helpful to us. Do you have further questions you'd like to address to the AG, or has he covered?
Well,
they were not signed up to speak. We don't want to put them on the spot. I guess there's no further...
I would have a question.
You would. All right. Please come forward, Cheryl.
My name is Cheryl Pellegrini, Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice, assigned to the Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section. I do have a couple of observations about this bill. I'd like to hear them. This bill and Senate Bill 261, which is the exact same bill, both put a finer point on what is already the law. It already is an unlawful trade practice to misrepresent the source or sponsorship of a communication or a solicitation. It already is the law to misrepresent the characteristics of any good, service, or real estate that you may be offering. And it already is the law to misrepresent, again, the point of origin or the source from which a solicitation is coming. And those are found in ORS 646608, sub 1, subsections A, B, D, and E. What this bill would do, as I said, is it just puts a finer point on the Unlawful Trade Practices Act by making it clear that it applies to commercial email, although I would note that the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, it already applies to any communication or method of solicitation. One limitation of this bill and Senate Bill 261 is that it does not apply to any commercial email sent to a business, because the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, by its very nature, it applies only to consumer or to business-to-consumer transactions involving retail goods or services as defined, which are those for personal, family, or household use. So as far as spam is as much a problem for businesses as it is for consumers, this bill will not reach that spam.
And Mary, you had a question, right?
I do, and my question has to do with Dr. Smith, who gave testimony. You know, many of these are already against the law.
Mm-hmm.
She continues to have no recourse and no response. What can the consumer do? I mean, to protect herself or to take recourse against someone who is exploiting her.
Madam Chair, Representative Gallegos, a couple of things there. Under the state of the law now, this bill would not change what would happen in Dr. Smith's case. She would have the same recourse available to her if this bill passed as she does now. Under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act and under this bill, the doctor would have the opportunity to file a private lawsuit alleging an Unlawful Trade Practices Act against the person who unlawfully co-opted her internet domain name. The issue is that if you're going to file a private suit, you need to establish that you've suffered some ascertainable loss of property. Just some ascertainable loss. Could be economic, could be non-economic, in order to establish your cause of action. She testified that she contacted the Attorney General's office, my section, in fact, and we gave her an email message to contact. Typically, what we will do is we'll take a complaint, and as you know, because we've talked about it before, we can't act on individual. We can't represent individuals. So, in order to take any action, we need to get a couple of complaints or find out that this person was doing it to more than one other person, and then we could take action under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. So that would be what was available to her now. If the person who's using her email address is using it in a way to obtain credit or anything else like that, then it becomes identity theft, and then it's a crime. And then it would be within the jurisdiction of the district attorney's office in whatever county doctor is located in.
Cheryl, can I ask you, since you are an attorney, about this putting the ADV in the address? You know, you see in magazines it'll say this is an advertisement, which I believe that is required to be on things in magazines that appear to be articles but are actually advertisements. It seems to me this is a similar type of thing, and I'm wondering why that would be unconstitutional.
Madam Chair, the issue about the ADV and whether or not it's constitutional is Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution, as it's currently being interpreted by the Oregon Supreme Court, does not distinguish between commercial and non-commercial speech, so that any law that requires that speech contain or not contain certain elements may be considered to be targeting the content of the speech. If a law targets the content of speech, at least under a quick review of Article 1, Section 8, it would be unconstitutional on its face unless the purpose for the law related to a historical exception that was in the Constitution at the time it was passed.
So, in the case of these magazines that have these things in them, would that also be unconstitutional? And if so, I'm wondering why there hasn't been a lawsuit. I don't know of any.
Well, Representative, of course, there's a difference, I think, between a magazine. I don't know in the magazine. I know what you're talking about, and a lot of times they're for pharmaceuticals companies.
Right.
I don't know if they're doing that voluntarily or they're doing it pursuant to some law. But what we're talking about, if the advertisers wanted to voluntarily put ADV in their subject line, that would be fine. But here we're talking about a law where they would mandate it,
mm-hmm.
and that's the difference. And I don't know who mandates or if there is a mandate that advertisers in magazines put ADV in the content of their magazine. I don't think it's a law in Oregon.
Maybe a federal, because it is in federal. I mean, it's across the country. I guess the way I see it is that you're not limiting their speech. You are giving the consumer the choice whether they want to listen to that speech.
Well, and Madam Chair, that's the idea that we had in mind when we drafted Senate Bill 121, which, as you've heard, creates a mechanism that's similar to Oregon's no-call law. And it, we did that with Article 1, Section 8 in mind, and thinking that wouldn't it be best to give Oregonians, whether they're businesses or individuals, a way to announce that they don't want to receive any unsolicited commercial email. And they would announce that by essentially adding their name to a registry or a list that would be maintained by a private list administrator, public-private partnership, and that once they added their email address to that list, if they receive spam, then there would be a cause of action under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. And it wouldn't implicate speech at all. It would be the equivalent, I think, of hanging a no solicitation sign on your door.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment, Madam Chair, that this issue has been under robust discussion because many of us had the same doubts that you've expressed since email has the ability to, it's not simply free speech, but it has the ability to provide, it takes up space on our computers, it takes over some of our RAM, it has the ability to infect our computers, it has the ability to provide attached documents that do very nasty things, including stealing information off our computers. So there's a very strong safety and welfare component to being able to label a subject line. I think we have found a fairly ironclad way to avoid this constitutional issue that I've been working with Greg Chamoff on. The bills, we've been waiting to get this bill back. We should be getting it back today because, as you know, 5 p.m. is the deadline. So at this point, not.
I guess we beat morning. You to the punch, huh?
And I think it's a solvable. I think that the subject line is a solvable problem.
Okay. Thank you. Well, thank you very much, Cheryl.
Sure.
And okay, and then we do want to move on quickly.
Thank you.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Cheryl, does this language mirror exactly what's in the Washington law right now?
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, it does not.
Yeah.
This is different. This basically, as I said, it just adds spam to the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. The Washington law actually creates a list. Does a little bit. It's, the mechanism is a little bit different.
It's just reading this, it's not clear to me whether A, B, or C are independent of each other, whether it would be illegal to do any one of those things. And there's no conjunction at the end. It says or and. So it seems to be if you were offering things for sale or rent, it had a misleading subject line, that would be in itself prohibited. I guess that's it.
That's correct. And I just want to say in closing, Madam Chair, that the work group is being run by my office. And if either you or any member of your committee would like to join, we'd be happy to send you a notice. The next meeting is this Wednesday from 11:30 to 12:45 at the Department of Justice. And if you just tell me who I should send an email to, I'd be happy to do that.
If you could direct it to Megan, we will work on having people there.
That's great. I agree with Mr. Gardner and with Representative Merkley that I think that between all of the bills that are now out, a combination of them, I think, would yield something that was truly protective of all Oregonians. So, thank you very much
for your work. I appreciate it. Closing the public hearing on House Bill 2737. And thank you, everyone, who gave us very good information. And I'm going to sheet here.
You ready?
Opening a work session for the possible introduction of committee measures. Representative Kitts.
Madam Chair, I would move that LC numbers 1150, 1152, 1976, 3072, 3443, 3155, 3277, 3279, 3280, and 3278 be introduced as committee bills.
Representative Kitts has made a motion to move LC draft 1150, 1152, 1976, 3072, 3443, 3155, 3277, 3279, 3280, and 3278 to be introduced as committee bills. Is there discussion? Representative Rosenbaum.
I'm not objecting to this. I just want to make it clear that introducing this as committee bills is not indicating necessary support for
That is correct, Representative Rosenbaum. Much of this is done as a courtesy because this is bill drop day, and we may be hearing these, we may not be hearing these. Okay. Further discussion. Is there objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Is there anything else for the good of the committee? Thank you all for your attention, and we are adjourned.